from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the lawyer for former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez accuses the state medical examiner of holding Hernandez's brain illegally. Also, questions about content on Facebook after a man posts video of him killing another man. And Reshma Sajani, founder of Girls Who Code, on getting more women into computer science.
One, I think, is culture. Like, I think you can't be what you cannot see.
Plus, an exhibit in Boston's South End of miniature models of Syria before and after the start of the country's war.
I wanted to remodel this for people to relate of how it feels to call this home on a daily basis.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're going to start today with the latest developments in the case of former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez. He was found hanging in his prison cell yesterday. Governor Baker spoke about Hernandez's death today.
Look, anytime anybody kills himself in a prison, something clearly went wrong. Although, as one of the prison advocates said, that can be a tough issue to manage sometimes. But obviously the investigation that DOC will do will hopefully give us some guidance on steps we could take going forward.
Just moments ago, Hernandez's lawyer, Jose Baez, told reporters that the state medical examiner is illegally holding Hernandez's brain.
It is our position that they are holding Aaron Hernandez's brain illegally. They have released the body and withheld Aaron's brain.
Nestor Ramos has been covering this story for the Boston Globe, and he joins us on the line. Hello, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us more about what Hernandez's attorney, Jose Baez, said today. What does it mean exactly that the medical examiner is holding Hernandez's brain illegally?
Well, he alleged that after the autopsy was conducted at the medical examiner's office here in Boston, the family had requested that the brain go to Boston University, which has a very renowned brain research department, and had made arrangements for the brain to be handed over this morning at 10 a.m. And he said that when BU came to collect the brain, that they had essentially changed their minds, that it wasn't turned over, and he organized the press conference shortly thereafter. Okay. Now, in the last 2 minutes or so, I've gotten a statement from Dan Bennett, who's the state secretary of public safety and security, saying that the state's investigation into Hernandez's death is ongoing and may require further analysis. He said that no one is going to stand in the way of the family's wishes for Boston University to have Aaron Hernandez's brain.
So we should say, though, that the reason it would have gone to BU, just for folks who don't know, was to try to figure out if he suffered a CTE or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is something that BU has been studying among football players. Is that right?
Right. And there had been some speculation that might be something that the family would want looked at or others would want looked at. It's shown up in the autopsies of a handful of former NFL players who've had problems.
So is he suggesting then that could have even been a factor in Hernandez's apparent suicide?
Well, Baez was pretty cagey about that at the news conference. He was asked that several times and said simply that their own investigation is going to take a lot of avenues and be a complete look at what might have contributed to it. He wouldn't go so far as to speculate about whether or not Hernandez was suffering from CTE.
He's also said some very critical things about the state. Is that right?
Yes, and he continued to do so today. He said that a lot of the reason they insist that the brain go to BU is because they don't have confidence in the state medical examiner's office.
Why is that? Do you know?
Well, there certainly has been a history of some problems at the office, the criminal cases against Hernandez hinged in some part on the medical examiner's office, so questioning their credibility was part of that case as well.
There are also reports today that there was a Bible verse written on Hernandez's forehead before he died early yesterday morning. Any news on that?
Well, Baez was asked about that as well during the news conference and wouldn't confirm it. He was pretty standoffish, I'd say, about that claim. Said he didn't know anything about it. Someone asked if it had been in Hernandez's handwriting, and he declined to address. He really declined to address anything except the brain issue. Hmm. There are still a lot of questions about the suicide itself, whether it was or wasn't. But those investigations, which I guess now are parallel investigations by the state and his own lawyers, are ongoing.
All right, Nestor Ramos, reporter at the Boston Globe. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's been a busy week for Facebook. On Sunday, a video was posted on Facebook showing the murder of 74-year-old Robert Godwin in Cleveland. On Monday, Godwin's daughter, Nausea, told CNN that Facebook was how she found out that her father had been killed.
Everybody started calling me and texting me, did you see that video? Did you see that video? And I'm like, what are y'all talking about? And my family started calling me, and at first I was angry. I'm like, why would they do that to my dad? Why would you put it online? Like, I couldn't believe it was my dad.
And then on Tuesday, the so-called Facebook killer, Steve Stevens, shot and killed himself after a police chase. That same day, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg spoke about the shooting and how his company is still learning how to monitor content.
We have a lot more to do here, and we're reminded of this this week by the tragedy in Cleveland. And our hearts go out to the family and friends of Robert Godwin Sr., and we have a lot of work, and we will keep doing all we can to prevent tragedies like this from happening.
Hiawatha Bray is a technology writer for the Boston Globe, and he joins us to talk about this. Hi there.
Hello.
So you write in your column today, Facebook Live has done far more good than harm, and for every toxic video, there are millions of innocent ones. So tell me, though, you know, why do you think that, or how do you think Facebook should monitor content to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again?
Well, by their own admission, they're going to have to work a lot harder at it. But they're up against a huge problem because Facebook Live has been so hugely successful. And by the way, I should point out, they're not the only one doing this. Also, on a much smaller scale, you have Twitter doing something similar with a service called Periscope. And now that that is out there, you're going to have people all over the world at any given moment, thousands of people who are broadcasting video streams, mostly of perfectly harmless content. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. It can even be socially beneficial with people covering news events. Or, you know, we have the case of the guy who was shot by a police officer and his girlfriend videotaped it and streamed it live. And that is leading now to a further intense investigation of police brutality. So it can actually do some good.
So you know what, Hiawatha? Let's play a little bit of tape from that to remind people of that story. Because right now we're talking about something negative about, as we played in the beginning, we played the tape from CNN, that this man's daughter found out that her father had been murdered because his murder was posted on Facebook. And people said, did you see this video? I mean, it's an awful story. But as
Absolutely.
You mentioned, there are positives. And so in July, Philando Castile, he was the man shot by a police officer during a traffic stop in Chicago, and his girlfriend Diamond Reynolds began streaming video on Facebook. We have a little bit of clip of that. Let's listen.
Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot 4 bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
So that's what you were referring to as a good example. And the officer involved in that has been charged. But aren't there other ways to do this without doing something live? Because you obviously run the risk of exposing people to something very tragic, as you did in the case of the murder of Robert Godwin.
Yeah, well, I don't know how you put this particular genie back in the bottle. What Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook did was they took a lot of capabilities that have already been in our smartphones for a long time, and by connecting them to Facebook, what he really did was provide us the channel, the place to show these videos, the place to transmit these videos. There have been apps around for years that let you beam video to your friends, say. Or, you know, you could do a FaceTime call. But suddenly, now you've got a way to beam the video to hundreds or thousands of people all at once. And that's something that people didn't previously have the ability to do. And clearly, they didn't think through the fact that there were going to be a small but very scary percentage of people who would use this to just show terrible, terrible things. According to one estimate in the Wall Street Journal as of early March, something like 50 crimes have been shown worldwide, including murders, rapes, assaults, have been broadcast over Facebook Live. So it's really
in,
a very
in what time
serious
frame?
Story. Oh, that's over about a year, because it's only been around for a little over a year. But let's be clear, at that same time, during that same period, millions of videos have been pumped out, and most of them are perfectly harmless. It's kind of like an analogy with terrorism. In any given time, there are going to be dozens or hundreds of terrorist acts, but nobody thinks about the fact that those same technologies are used countless times every day for perfectly harmless things.
But, you know, I think that some folks might argue, though, why do we need another platform or even a platform for anybody to post videos? You don't know what's going to happen, right? You can't possibly flag it. Many of these are live. They're happening as we speak. If someone is going to kill someone, you don't know until it's already been done on the video. So you're risking exposing viewers to violent or very disturbing content. And, you know, people might think, are more cat videos really worth this risk, Hiawatha?
Yes, I think they are. I mean, come on, in all fairness, how are we supposed to all stop using this absolutely wonderful technology because an incredibly tiny handful of people? That's like saying, let's shut down the airline industry. Somebody might put a bomb on a plane. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You can't simply end technological advancement because there are bad people who are going to use it. Let's ban cars because Bonnie and Clyde will use them to get away from the next bank that they rob. But that doesn't make any sense. Yep. What we've got to do is figure out how to minimize the chance that people can do things like this. And I come up with a few suggestions. My personal favorite is the one about how we add extra time to the prison sentences of anybody who commits a crime and then broadcasts it or posts a video online. I think that's a relatively simple thing you could do. You could say, all right, if you commit a crime and are convicted of it, and we find out you streamed the crime live or posted a video about it afterwards, you're going to get an extra 5 years or 10 years or whatever. I think that would cut down on it pretty darn fast, personally.
Well, I mean, that, you know, instead of what, hate crime increased fines,
yeah,
you would have online crime increased fines?
Yeah, you would have, exactly. You would have some kind of a special crime for things that you, a special additional penalties for crimes that are broadcast to the public so that people can see you committing a crime. You should be punished extra for doing that.
But doesn't have...
That's one possible way of dealing with it.
Doesn't Facebook have some kind of responsibility here? What does it need to do to make sure that these things aren't posted?
Absolutely. Well, they say they're doing all kinds of things, and I'm inclined to believe them because this is terrible publicity for them, but they're going to have to do even more. They wouldn't tell me in any detail what they were working on. I went looking for some technologies that people are working on in other venues, and I talked to a guy who used to be at the Bedford company iRobot working on computer vision for robots that could see their way through the world. Now, the problem with doing something like that, of course, is that you would have to devise a way for robots to recognize what they are seeing in real time. And so they developed a technology like that, which they call Dextro. That company has now been bought by the same company that makes those police body cams, and they're going to use it so that when you see a police body video, they're going to be able to have software that can instantly tell you, at least in a general way, what that is a video of. Well, he was talking about the idea that AI, artificial intelligence, might be able to look at incoming videos for a company like Facebook and say, okay, we don't know exactly what's going on here, but I just saw a gun in that video. Alert, alert, there's a gun in that video. And then a human being would be contacted and asked, hey, you should look at this. There are other things that people could do. For example, this is something we didn't talk about here, but there are people talking about the idea of using speech recognition to recognize what people are saying in a video as they talk about, oh, I'm going to, like this guy, if they'd had that kind of technology and they're working on it, and somebody says, I'm going to kill somebody on a Facebook video, that might be a flag that would immediately get somebody, a human being, to look at the video and make sure that this is okay. Keep in mind, they don't necessarily have to look at every single video. I mean, for example, the Wall Street Journal broadcasts on Facebook Live quite a lot. NBC, other companies mm-hmm. do. I don't think you have to check their videos. But other videos, you could come up with ways to check them, and artificial intelligence is getting better and better at that. It's going to be a while, but I think companies like Facebook have a moral obligation to make the investment.
All right. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
And speaking of Facebook, it's among the technology companies trying to get more computer science into schools. And that's something that Reshma Sajani is doing as well. She's the CEO of Girls Who Code. That's a nonprofit that works to increase the number of women in computer science by teaching it to young women in high school during summer workshops. And she'll be doing some of those workshops in Boston this summer. Sejani's also a former candidate for Congress and for public advocate in New York, and she says those failed campaigns helped her succeed. Reshma Sejani joins us in studio to tell us more. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're so welcome. Very excited to be here.
I've read that you said your mission is to build the largest pipeline of future female engineers in the United States.
Absolutely.
It's a big mission.
It's a big, big mission. And I think we're getting there. I have a lot of faith that, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world I think that we want to solve, but this is actually one that I really believe that we could solve. We can close the gender gap in computer science and technology, and I think we can do it in our lifetimes.
So that's why you started Girls Who Code?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a quite unlikely person to start an organization teaching girls to code. I'm not a coder. I didn't major in computer science. My family came here as refugees, and I've always been passionate about public service. And I was running for office when I was 33 years old. I ran for United States Congress in New York City. I lost miserably, but I saw the gender divide in schools. And again, as someone who's had a job since they were 12 years old and am a firm believer in the American dream, I was like, where are the girls? Like, we know that, you know, women are the majority in college, the majority in our labor force, 45% of American breadwinners. And we know that the future is in technology.
And you have some unbelievable statistics in terms of young women who take advanced placement computer science classes. Yeah. Tell me some of those.
Sure. So essentially in the 1980s, about 37% of computer science graduates were women. And today that number is less than 18%. We have about 500,000 open jobs in computing, but women make up only 24% of the computing workforce. And actually, in 10 years, if nothing changes, will be 22%. So in some ways, the problem is getting worse. And there's also a systematic educational problem, too. You know, only 1 out of 10 American high schools offers computer science. So the vast majority of our children, boys and girls, don't get access to learn a skill set that they need to survive in the 21st century. And it's very impactful when it comes to women, because most studies will show that if a young girl hasn't taken computer science in high school, she's unlikely to go take it in college.
So you look at all of this and you see the lack of women in technology and the lack of young girls getting into this, and you want to figure out why. Have you figured it out? Tell us why this is happening.
So I think I have two big things that I think. One, I think, is culture. Like, I think you can't be what you cannot see. I'm an attorney. I decided I wanted to be a lawyer when I was like 13 years old. When I saw Kelly McGillis on The Accused, I thought she was awesome. And I was like, Dad, I want to be her. And I think, you know, if you think about it, in the 1970s, we had a similar problem when it came to female lawyers. Only, you know, what was it, less than 5% of lawyers in the 1970s were women. And today that number is over 50%. You know, you can't be what you cannot see.
But you became this. And
yes,
you
because I saw bad. Kelly McGillis on The Accused.
But also that you're doing this coding.
Yes,
you know,
but
well.
I think I'm doing, but I think that my point is that culture really shapes what young girls think that they can do. And I think in technology, the opposite thing has happened. In the 1980s, you saw kind of the birth of the programmer, right? The white guy in a hoodie who's sitting in a basement somewhere, you know, staring at a screen. And that was in Revenge of the Nerds and War Games, right? And today on Silicon Valley on HBO. So the image that we have portrayed in the media of who is a computer scientist is a white young kid who's nerdy and dorky, and he's not doing anything that's socially interesting. And so girls look at him and they say, I don't want to be him. And they opt out. Mm. And so you see this really opting out happening in high school, when I think the girls are the most susceptible to culture.
Explain a little bit about your program, Girls Who Code. It works in the summer.
We have two models. We have a summer immersion program. So we essentially build a summer camp in a technology company. This summer we have three in Boston, and it's a free program for rising juniors and seniors in high school. And for 7 weeks they learn how to code, and at the end of those 7 weeks they actually build a product. And the results have been phenomenal. This is our sixth summer. Oh, my God. The results have been amazing. 90% of our graduates in that program are going on to major or minor in computer science. Mm-hmm. So it's converting their interest.
Is there a way to work with schools?
Yes.
Instead of doing a separate program. You're doing some, right?
Yes.
There's some clubs after school, but what about really integrating?
In-school program. It's a great question. And we think about this a lot. There's a large movement to get computer science in every classroom. And that movement is by getting computer science to be elective, right? So it's not a mandatory requirement. So then what happens is that you don't change the gender dynamics because you haven't changed the culture part that we talked about, some of the bravery things that I talk about. And so what we're trying to do is as we support in-classroom programs is to say, okay, what's the impact of those programs on girls? Like, do you have role models? Are you showcasing the original pioneers of computer science? Are you thinking constructively about how you're calling on girls for questions and how you're teaching computer science so it's project-based, right? And it's computational thinking, and it's not just about regurgitating a programming language that they may not feel connected to. But of course, the way to solve this problem the fastest is through in-classroom instruction. But we believe that until that happens and until it's, quite frankly, mandatory, the after-school programs play a critical role because it brings girls to come together in a single-sex environment that they feel confident in their abilities.
And you think that's important to be in
Huge.
A single-sex environment?
Hmm? Huge. I do. You know, I think that we have not raised our girls to be comfortable with failure. And they feel like so many of their abilities are fixed. So imagine if you're in a computer science class, you're 16 years old, you're the only girl. You have all these loud, brash boys who are like, I know the answer. I know the answer. I built a video game when I was 2 years old. And you're struggling because coding is hard for everyone. Mm. You're likely to drop out. And that's what's happening across classrooms across the country.
But, you know, it's happening in other fields, too. We've been talking about this for a long time, right?
Yeah.
About the wage disparity between women and men, right? And all of the, and I'm old enough to know that we've been talking about different academic achievement rates in certain fields like science and math for young men and young women. And so you get to something, I think, very profound there in terms of women and women being able to assert themselves and feel confident in themselves. And that, how do you teach that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about how do you undo perfectionism, right? And how do you teach girls to embrace bravery? And so I think one of the ways that I think about this is, you know, when you're great, whether it's you're a great athlete, a great leader, you're often living at the edge of your ability in critical feedback. So you need critical feedback to get better. So if I've been raised to feel like I need to be perfect at everything, when I hear feedback, doesn't feel good. And it makes me feel like I can't do this and I need to go find something else that I'm immediately good at. And so to me, it's about figuring out how do we get girls comfortable at a really early age with critical feedback and with rejection. So like one tactic that I use is if you had met me when I was 16 or if you are at 41, if you come to my house right now, I have a rejection letter on my refrigerator. I was recently rejected from my community board, which is like the lowest level of government that you can serve in.
Oh no.
For their education committee. Something that you think maybe I know something about. But I put that letter up and it hurt to not get in and to not be able to serve. But I put that letter up on my fridge to just remind myself, right, that I can keep trying and it's not going to break me. And I know that I know something about education. Like, I know that I would do well on that committee. Their loss. Mm. And so instead of it breaking me, how do you get rejection and feedback to embolden you to be better, to try harder, and to not let someone else's judgment on your worth affect your own self-confidence? It's funny, my son's 2 years old, and so I was recently at his music class and, you know, listen, I'm a busy mom. Like if you meet my son, he normally like has a booger in his nose and there's like food filled on him. And like, I call him my little pig pen. Right. But it is what it is. Right. And it was funny when I was sitting with him at his music class, I was watching the little girls and all of them like perfect little bows, immaculately dressed. Their bow moved to the left or the right, the nanny or the mother would come up and fix it. So like, imagine at 2 years old, you're constantly pricked and prodded and you know what I mean? Like, and that's, those micro acts add up. But what about those brash boys in the classroom? Why are they not affected? Your son may be baby Pigpen.
They're not.
But there are other boys who also have to have perfect haircuts before they go to public events.
And they have
those pressures as well. So, and they do become those brash people. They don't put that rejection letter on the refrigerator, right? Mm-hmm. They don't even talk about it. They pretend it never happened. And so, and once you get into a professional setting, those men are getting promoted, even if they may know less than their female counterpart. What do you do about that?
So I think it's because... And there's been a lot talked about this. It's because I think women are rewarded for their performance and men are rewarded for their potential. Like, I think about, for me, you know, I've lost two races. And I do think if I run again one day, I'm going to be judged much more harshly for those failures than if it was a similarly situated man who lost a bunch of times, who's had now a proven track record of actually building something. His failures are going to be seen as successes. One thing I will say is that I do believe that I was one of the national organizers of the Women's March, and I'm, you know, very active on lots of different issues, but we have found our voice. You know, women
think
have absolutely. I think women have found their voice. Like, women are outraged, and we're using our voice, and we're not going to take it anymore. That doesn't mean everything's going to change tomorrow, but I am much more hopeful about the state of our affairs.
Reshma Sajani is the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the new tech sensation called blockchain. What is it? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The buzzword in tech circles these days is blockchain. The MIT Tech Review held a conference this week on the business of blockchain. It looked at things like big banks and startups. And if you're wondering, as we were, quite frankly, what is blockchain? Well, we've asked WBUR's Asma Khalid to explain in our weekly Bostonomics segment on the innovation economy. Hi there, Asma.
Hey, Deb.
Okay, so there's a question. What is blockchain?
And it is a very valid question.
Okay.
So Deb, if you've ever run a business, you're probably familiar with a ledger. It's essentially a list of transactions. It's something that every multinational corporation, every small mom and pop sort of mainstream business uses to keep track of expenses. So in the most sort of basic form, a blockchain is a shared digital ledger that'll keep every one of those transactions secure. And advocates say that by having this system digital and public, it makes it easier to prove, track, and sort of trust and audit all of those sales. Blockchain is an interesting technology because it's actually the underlying bit behind Bitcoin. You've probably heard of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
It's that form of digital currency that made a splash a few years ago. And I asked Neha Narula about this. She leads the digital currency initiative at the MIT Media Lab. She told me that by looking at Bitcoin, it helped them understand really what was technologically possible.
Bitcoin showed us a way to do secure financial transfer without any trusted third parties. And we just quite simply hadn't seen that before. But, you know, we'd never seen digital money transfer without a bank being involved. And now we see it. And it's pretty cool. And it's given us a lot of ideas for other things we could do.
And so, Deb, Bitcoin itself has kind of had these ups and downs, right, in terms of popularity. But it's the underlying technology, the blockchain, that seems more exciting to a lot of tech experts.
And why exactly is this considered such a significant thing?
Well, you know, as Neha said, it seems like tech people have realized that blockchain can be used for a lot more than just Bitcoin. It has the potential to cut out the middleman and create this digital record that's just sort of in all facets of life. People sort of say you could have this, right? We have no way of digital record keeping at this point. The evangelists of blockchain technology say to me that it will do to the financial system what the internet did for media. And so, you know, that's a pretty bold statement.
Right.
And you see this kind of appetite. At the conference that I was at, you had everyone from big banks who are already investing in this technology to corporations like Procter & Gamble. You had a lot of different sectors of people within the sort of traditional economic sphere there. And so tech experts say that this can be used for a lot of different ways. It can be used, say, to track diamonds so that fake rocks could be found more easily. It can be used to track tainted pork so that we could have food recalls that would be easier. It would even just sort of allow us to have easier and smoother bank-to-bank transfers. And I asked Brian about this, Brian Bernhoff, I'm sorry. He's involved with this open source hyper ledger system that is essentially like sort of an open source blockchain platform.
Now, every example I could give you of where you might use a blockchain, you could come to me and say, well, yeah, couldn't you just leave that up to Google to run for you, or Amazon or Uber to run for you? And the answer would be yes, but there's a cost to that trust. And in a world where we trust our institutions less and less, having technologies that help us conduct business and get things done without needing to depend upon central third parties seems ever more important.
And so, Deb, Brian told me that just how the internet revolutionized how we communicate, blockchain will revolutionize transactions, he says, right? Financial transactions, which he admits is probably not as sexy. It's a little bit wonky and harder for people to understand, but he thinks just as transformative.
So make it a little easier then. Where might we see this, or sort of the theory behind blockchain in
sure.
use?
So a lot of it's experimentation. You know, one woman told me that it's kind of akin to where the internet was in the 80s. So she said, you know, we're at a point where there's a bunch of nerds, her words, not mine, sitting around at MIT and Berkeley kind of sending emails to one another, meaning it's just at a really experimentation level. But I will say that I asked a couple of people about this, including Amber Balday. She leads the blockchain efforts at JP Morgan, and she said they're really interested from a bank perspective about how they can use this tech behind the scenes.
People feel like when they transfer money from point A to point B, it generally shows up in at point B in a very short period of time. It'll be reflected on your other statement. But behind the scenes, that is not truly what's happened. So there's still a multi-day settlement process that happens when cash is moved around, even internally between branches.
So, Deb, what they're interested in doing is using blockchain technology that would allow there to be sort of instantaneous transfers, right, between bank to bank. So if I wanted to wire transfer you money, it looks like it's happening relatively instantaneously, but it's not. She's like, there's a lot of sort of back-channel settlements, right, for them to sort of prove how much money I had and different partners in this. Mm-hmm. And so this would essentially sort of free up the system, make it better in terms of finding fewer errors. There's one other quick example I want to bring up to you. It's an interesting project for how this is being used. A startup called Everledger that's using this blockchain to identify data on millions of individual diamonds. So they're tracking more than 40 features in a diamond. This would be the cut, the color, the quality. And the thinking is that they can help jewelers trace and track blood diamonds. It's a sort of global digital registry for diamonds. So I'm going to leave it there. I will say that I'm working on a sort of digital explainer for the web. That'll be up shortly, and you can sort of leaf through that to sort of better understand what exactly blockchain is and why you should care.
Okay. Thanks so much, Asma.
You're welcome.
Asma Khalid leads our new business and technology team, Bostonomics. You can follow them on Twitter at BostonOMIX. We want to take a moment now to congratulate Sydney Chafee. She won the National Teacher of the Year Award today. Chafee's a humanities teacher at Codman Academy Charter Public School in Dorchester. She was among four finalists from California, Maryland, and Wisconsin. Chafee spoke with Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty in January when she was named a finalist, and she told us then about how she didn't even turn to teaching until after college.
You know, looking back now, I can sort of see it. You know, I was bossy and I like to learn things. And so I wanted...
Well, let's rephrase that and call it you were a natural leader.
There it is. No, I wanted to be a writer. So I went to Sarah Lawrence College to be a poet. And one of my mentors there was Lita Sizer, who is the daughter of Ted Sizer, great education reformer. And so she sort of started to introduce me to this world of progressive education. And I started doing some reading. So I never studied education in college, not until I went to grad school. And then, you know, I realized very quickly, oh, this is what I love. This is my passion. I'm good at it. And how wonderful to have a job where I feel really good every day and I feel really excited about what I'm doing and I'm constantly learning.
And that inspiration, Chafee told us, came from her mother.
When I started kindergarten, my mother went back to college. She had left school to be a mom, and she'd stayed home with my sister for 5 years, and then I was born. She stayed home with me for 5 years, so she'd been out of school for 10 years. I was in kindergarten, and I was learning how to read and write, and she was getting her degree. And then she didn't stop there. She went on and got a master's. She started working toward a doctorate. So my whole childhood growing up, my mother was either a student or a teacher. And so I came up in this house of really strong women with the understanding that to be educated and to know things was truly valuable and was powerful. So one of the things that I'm excited about with this whole journey that I'm on is being able to have my own daughter see that. You know, she's only two, but I'm so proud of the fact that she will be able to look back and know that her mother did these things while being a mom. That's really special to me.
Sydney Chafee, congratulations on the National Teacher of the Year Award today. We'll be back after a break. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. At the Lanoue Fine Art Gallery in Boston's South End this month is a haunting exhibit of works created by architect Mohamed Hafez. He's created dozens of models of the streets of his native Syria.
And I realized while I can't go home, I could recreate home the streetscapes that I love the most about Old Damascus. The balconies, these laundry lines, the overlapping architecture, minarets and churches dancing together in the skyline, people conversing, overlapping market activity on the ground level. So much richness in the Syrian fabric.
Hafez started creating these 14 years ago to deal with his homesickness. At that time, he was in his first year at Iowa State University, 6,000 miles away from Old Damascus. And as the conflict in Syria erupted, his work changed. Instead of pristine streets, Hafez constructed apartment buildings with gaping holes and electrical wires exposed, half-shattered lights still flickering in exposed hallways. Hafez used foam and whatever objects he finds outside to create these works. And throughout the exhibit, you hear audio from some of the video footage that's been taken during the war. When the war began, Hafez says he was in such despair that he couldn't even pick up a pencil for 2 years. And when he did, his emotions poured into the rubble of his city.
It's sort of interesting to look at where I started and how it progressed over the years. And the ironic fact that it kind of represents the sad history of the nation, going from very prosperous days to a vicious war, ending with the plight of refugees today.
Let's look at some more. Perfect. Want to look at some more? You've got what, about, I'd say, two dozen?
Yeah, there's a good 26, maybe?
Yeah, about two dozen different different miniature settings here. You have a favorite?
That's
talking about a favorite child, right?
That's confidential. What you should note is at a given time, I am working on anywhere from 4 to 7 pieces. I never work on a single piece at a time.
Why?
I think I would go crazy detailing one piece. I put so much detail in these works, and I go back and see, okay, what do you really want added to you? And I go back and look at my many, many jars of found objects, and I come back with an object, and I stick it in there.
These are all made of found objects.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everything except the architectural part, the walls and the floors, are found objects. These are Christmas tree lights, ornaments. These are clock components. These are limbs from my backyard that I cut to make the rafters.
Oh, it's really beautiful.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
How long does it take you, would you say, to do one? Typically.
Anywhere from 3 to 6 to 7 months, because I work on them continuously.
In these down here, these pieces that you have about 5 or 6 right here, and they're all in either suitcases or old typewriter cases.
Correct.
What does that mean?
These were started and influenced by my family's personal story of having to leave our beautiful home in Damascus. Some of these have a luxurious French Baroque interior with golden wallpaper and a nice couch representing the established lives that they left behind.
But the background is a destroyed city. I mean, it's a beautiful sofa in the middle of a bullet-ridden wall.
Mm. Exactly. They didn't choose to leave. They were forced to leave right then and there. And sometimes with very little notice, they couldn't take more than a suitcase with them.
So we've gone from nostalgia and sort of some of the destruction to the refugee crisis, mm-hmm. To now over here,
Oh, His Majesty.
His Majesty. Now, this is also very large, mounted on the wall, and it looks like there are lots of houses coming out.
Correct.
And then in the middle, there is this marble-floored miniature bathroom.
Correct. Luxurious bathroom.
Luxurious bathroom. Do you want to describe the rest of this for me and what the thinking was here?
Well, as you could appreciate, our nation, the American nation, had a kind of a rough patch last year with a lot of statements being said that sort of insulted and affected many, many people. It got me thinking about how some people in power think they can just grab the mic and say whatever they want and paint millions and millions of people with one wide brush, causing judgments, causing false perceptions, and spreading hate. Well, I saw it as I called it verbal diarrhea, our daily dose of verbal diarrhea. So this is a global piece. The character in the image is nobody. It's composed of many, many people smashed together with a computer software. And it talks about how these characters feel they're entitled or they're allowed to just sit there and defecate on the rest of society.
We should say the character is the picture is in a gold frame, a sort of a frame that's too large for your luxurious bathroom in the middle of the setting here.
Well, they live with egos bigger than existence.
So they need pictures.
They need pictures and they need gold frames and they need crowns. Yet our houses, us, the people, we're this small in comparison. Yet we are...
You almost look like birdhouses. Like,
yeah, exactly, in comparison. And you can see the splashes on the houses receiving all these daily blessings of media and spicy statements.
So you said this wasn't political. I think it might be a tad political.
A tad bit political. A tad bit.
Now, this is also very disturbing and very intricate. This is a large cityscape as well. This one's called We Have Won, right?
We Have Won, yes.
What does that mean? Because it doesn't look like a victory scene.
Oh, to some leaders, this is victory. We have won. This started after seeing a photograph in the newspaper of a residential neighborhood that was completely decimated. The facades of all the buildings were just blown off. And in the middle of this neighborhood, there was a banner that said, "We will rebuild it together." How could you carpet bomb your own nation and promise to rebuild it? I felt as though somebody had wiped their own family clean, killed them all, destroyed all the cities, and said, "I have won," standing over the bones of our culture and civilization.
And also in the background, you hear the shots being fired. Where is that sound from?
That sound is taken from real footage on ground in Syria. And you hear them saying, "Darab, darab," which means they have dropped the bomb. So these helicopters and jets would fly over, and people, he's just yelling, "Where's your kid? Did it drop it at the hospital?" "No, I think it dropped it at the post office." And you hear the shrapnels, and you hear the bomb hitting, and people panicking and running around and searching, "Where's your kids?" Then you hear the gunshots. And so that means there are people continuously living in this situation under attack every day. And that's what I probably wanted to get through the flickering lights, the bad electricity service. And the sound finishes with the call to prayer that I had recorded in last time I was in my home country. And it's the call to prayer from my parents' balcony. And you hear our birds, you hear the skies so peaceful, you hear the pigeons flying in the skies. And that was a moment of peace that is, of course, is no longer existent. And I merged this audio with the status quo. And so it takes you on a very nostalgic and heavy emotional trip.
Oh, there's a TV screen next to this too.
That's a drone footage of Homs, a heavily affected and full of destruction city in northern Syria.
Oh my gosh.
And it blew my mind seeing this drone footage just flying over. There isn't a single wall that hasn't been affected. There isn't a single building that is intact.
This was in 2016.
This is in 2016. So you could see where I pull my inspiration from. And that's where you see the slabs hanging with the rebar showing.
Just completely destroyed. I mean, the whole city looks just completely destroyed. It looks like a bad movie. Right?
Yes. It's a bad dream. Sadly, it's our reality. You know, in our local media, this doesn't get shown. So I wanted to remodel this for people to relate of how it feels to stand in such streetscape, how it feels to be, to call this home on daily basis. How does it feel to live like this? What is so desperate that leads a father to put his 2- and 3-year-old kid in a refugee float across the Mediterranean, middle of the night, knowing that 50% chance that boat is flipping, capsizing, and they're dying? What amount of desperation leads a parent to do that?
You know, you've said that one of the things about Syria for you was that you finally felt comfortable, right? Finally felt that you were home.
I was finally at home.
Do you feel at home in the United States?
Absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely.
So this is your home now?
This is my home. I truly believe in this. Home is where peace and tranquility is, and where dignity and respectful life is achieved. That's how I look at it. If I'm unable to build a decent life currently in Syria, that doesn't hold me from living somewhere else, living peacefully, sharing, caring about others, regardless of who they are, where they come from. And this is the beauty that always attracted my family to the United States, because that's the very values this great nation has been built on.
But you still miss Syria.
Undoubtedly. My blood is Syrian.
And will you continue to make these?
Absolutely.
You're still so immersed in it that you need to do it really as a way to...
It is my art therapy session. I can't describe to you how it feels to experience your home country deteriorate overseas. This work, this amount of detailed work so far has been the only thing that brought me peace and tranquility. And to be able to tell our story and getting a warm, warm reception from our audience is something that I'm honored with and I take very dear to my heart.
Do you still have any family in Syria?
Yes, we do.
Oh, quite a few.
Quite a bit. Oh. And we're always in contact with them.
So far, they're safe, though.
Yes, to a certain extent. We have been blessed to not lose any family members in this conflict. That doesn't mean that people have not been imprisoned or tortured or harassed.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. All right.
Well, thank you for showing us around. Beautiful work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking the time to look at the work.
The exhibit Homeland Insecurity is at the Lanoue Fine Art Gallery in Boston's South End through April 30th. You can find detailed images of Mohammed Hafez's work on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.